This is lecture number
21
by Robert Vinoy on the Major Prophets. Robert Vinoy was professor at Biblical Theological Seminary. His lecture on the Major Prophets, and this begins actually with the book of Daniel. We start a new section today, which is the book of Daniel. This is A in the outline. And capital A is introductory remarks, and the first section is problems with date and authorship of Daniel. So I want to discuss that with you in the first part of our session. Daniel, of course, is one of the prophetic books that is most often challenged as far as authenticity goes. There's a general consensus among critical scholars that the book of Daniel is fictional and that it was written shortly before 165 BC. The reason for that date is, it's felt by the critical scholars, that it reflects the situation of time when Israel was suffering under the persecutions of Antiochus Epiphanes from Syria, or what was then called Aram. That period of Antiochus Epiphanes is often known as the Maccabean period, when Judas Maccabeus and his brothers instigated the revolt against the oppression of Antiochus Epiphanes. And it's that historical context that critical scholars feel provides the background for the book. Of course, the book itself says that it was written by Daniel, and Daniel lived during the time of the Babylonian captivity. And you read of the transition from the Babylonian to the Persian period in the book of Daniel. Babylon fell to the Persians, to Cyrus specifically, in 539 BC. So that would place Daniel somewhere a little before, not subsequent to the date of 539, which is the transition between the Babylonian and Persian periods. This is, of course, about 400 years earlier than the critical scholars allege. Now, the reasons for that late date are basically three. I'd list them in this way. First, and I think this is really at the heart of the whole matter and the most important thing, is the following. There is an a priori assumption that genuine predictive prophecy does not occur. Then second, there are alleged historical errors in the Daniel material. If the writer were living back here in 165 BC and he's writing about something 400 years earlier, the theory is that he really didn't know his history very well, so he made these historical blunders, which the critics try to point out in the book of Daniel. Then the third line of argument is alleged late linguistic features. These are the three central lines of argument for the late date. Let's look at each one in turn. So first, the assumption that predictive prophecy does not happen. I think that's a basic question of worldview, whether or not one is open to divine interventions in history, in revelation, and in action. People that are not willing to accept that as a possibility are not able to accept genuine predictive prophecy. There are many who assume that the universe is a closed continuum of cause and effect relationships where there is no room for intervention by the supernatural. They work with that assumption and, therefore, exclude the possibility of revelation ever happening. Now, humanly speaking, it would be impossible for Daniel to know so much about the course of Israel's history future to his own time. I think that's clear. There's no way that a person with normal human facilities could write the material that's in the book of Daniel, because so much of it looks so far into the future with such amazing detail that, if you rule out the possibility of revelation, you would have to conclude that this is written after these things happened and are foisted upon us as prophecy. However, that conclusion itself creates some problems, and the main one is the succession of empires that's depicted in several places in the book of Daniel. We'll look at all this in more detail as we move along in the book. But in Daniel chapter 2, you have that image that Nebuchadnezzar dreamt about as a head of gold, breast and arms of silver, belly and thighs of bronze, and legs and feet of iron. There are four parts here, four different materials to that image. Each part is symbolic of an empire. In the context of chapter 2, an interpretation is given, and it is said, and I'm quoting here, You, Nebuchadnezzar, are the head of gold. End quote. So you start with the Babylonian Empire, and it seems that when you follow down the succession, you move from the Babylonians to the Persians. The Persians fell to the Greeks, and the Greeks fell to the Romans. So if you move through that succession of Babylonian, Persian, Greek, Roman empires, you've already created a problem here, because the Roman Empire is after 165 BC. In 165, you're still in the Greek period. So you've got Babylon, Persia, and Greece. Rome is too late to fit into the critical scheme of dating. So they see that problem, and what they do is then say it's Babylon, Median, Persian, and Greek empires. So they get four successive kingdoms in before the date in which they propose that Daniel was written, which again is around 165 BC. Now, the problem with that sequence is the Median kingdom historically never existed as an interval between the Babylonian and the Persian kingdoms. In other words, we move directly from the Babylonian to the Persian. The Medians had already been incorporated into the Medo-Persian Empire prior to that, with the Medo-Persian Empire defeating the Babylonians in 539 BC under Cyrus, as I mentioned before. There was never any succession from Median to Persian to Greek. The Babylonian kingdom fell to the Persians, and we have that in Daniel at the end of chapter 5. In that night, Belshazzar, king of the Chaldeans, was slain. Chaldea is just another name for Babylon. Darius the Mede took the kingdom. You see, you move right from the Babylonian to the Persian kingdom. So Darius the Mede took over the Babylonian kingdom. We'll have to talk about Darius the Mede, but that's one of those alleged historical heirs, alleged by the critics. But historically, it's clear, there's no question among historians, there was no such thing as a Median kingdom, and you don't find one in Daniel. Now, given the prophecies of Daniel, if the succession of kingdoms includes Media, then Daniel is historically erroneous. For the critical scholars, of course, that's no problem. You see, that fits into their scheme of things. They will claim the writer, Daniel, who was living in the Maccabean period, was confused about the earlier course of Israel's history. This writer, living at a later time and passing himself off as Daniel, is thought there was an independent existence of the Median kingdom in between the Babylonian and the Persian periods. The idea would be, to the critics, we know better. So this is another example of a historical error on the part of the writer Daniel. I guess they would claim that we have sources for Persian history, for Babylonian history for that matter, that Daniel presumably didn't have access to himself, or the writer didn't have access to, who passes himself off as Daniel. Of course, that's assuming that there's this anonymous, unknown writer representing himself as Daniel, living about 400 years after the time of Daniel, about 165 BC in the time of Antiochus Epiphanes. All right, so you see, the critical view is based on this assumption. Predictive prophecy simply does not happen. But so much in the book clearly rests on either divine revelation, or you will have to move the date and time of Daniel to account for the knowledge of these things by the writer. But in moving the date, you are still faced with other problems. All right, let's go on to alleged historical errors. One of the major alleged historical errors is the one that we've just been discussing, the existence of this apocryphal Median kingdom between the Babylonian and the Persian kingdoms. That, of course, is a major factor as far as alleged historical errors go. But there are some other alleged errors, such as the reference to Belshazzar as king instead of Nabonidus at the time when the Babylonian kingdom fell to the Persians. That's in those verses we just looked at the end of chapter 5 with Daniel. We read, "In that night was Belshazzar, king of the Chaldeans, slain, and Darius the Mede took the kingdom." End quote. Critical scholars say that's not accurate because Belshazzar was not the king at the time that the Babylonians fell to the Persians, but Nabonidus was. Now, I'll come back to that in a minute. But a second alleged historical error is the reference to Nebuchadnezzar as the father of Belshazzar. In Daniel chapter 5, verse 2, you read, quote, Belshazzar, while he tasted wine, commanded to bring the gold and silver vessels which his father Nebuchadnezzar had taken out of the temple which was in Jerusalem. End quote. It is alleged that this is inaccurate because Nebuchadnezzar was not Belshazzar's father. Belshazzar was a grandson, not a son. Third, it is said no such person as Darius the Mede ever existed. In Daniel chapter 5:31, Darius the Mede is said to have taken over the kingdom. That's the time of the victory of the Persians over the Babylonians. It's claimed that there was no such person as Darius the Mede. Darius the Mede didn't defeat the Babylonians. Cyrus did. So those are three alleged historical errors besides this apocryphal Median kingdom. Now, let's look at these alleged historical errors. There are reasonable responses to all of them. The first one about Nabonidus and Belshazzar. Babylonian historical sources show that Nabonidus made his son Belshazzar co-regent with him. Nabonidus himself left Babylon and went to northern Arabia to study astronomy, for that matter. It's interesting that Daniel chapter 5, verse 29 says, quote, Then, as commanded Belshazzar, they clothed Daniel with scarlet, put a chain of gold about his neck, made a proclamation concerning him that he should be the third ruler in the kingdom. End quote. That reference to Daniel's being the third ruler in the kingdom is fascinating. Why would he be the third ruler in the kingdom? This fits with what we know about Nabonidus's making Belshazzar co-regent. That's in Daniel chapter 5:29. So with Belshazzar as co-regent, Nabonidus was out of the capital city when it fell to the Persians. It's perfectly reasonable to read that in the night was Belshazzar, king of the Chaldeans, slain when the Persians took the city, that Belshazzar was second in the kingdom, and hence he could make Daniel third in the kingdom, not second. The reference to Nebuchadnezzar as the father of Belshazzar is simply Semitic usage. The term father is often used in the sense of ancestor, just as the term son is often used in the sense of descendant in Semitic usage. In Matthew chapter 1, verse 1, we have an example of son meaning descendant. We read Jesus Christ, the son of Abraham, the son of David. So in Daniel chapter 5, verse 2, where it said that Nebuchadnezzar was Belshazzar's father, and again in 5:22, where it says, And thou, O his son, O Belshazzar, you have not humbled your heart, father and son terminology is employed in the sense of ancestor and descendant. It's interesting in this little study guide on the book of Daniel that's been published by the JSOT Press, that is the Journal for the Study of the Old Testament. Well, they're putting out these study guides for all the Old Testament books. This one came out in 1985 and was reprinted in 1988. On page 31 of that book, I put a statement in your citations. Look at page 36 of your citations. The author of this little book argues for the late date of Daniel. However, he offers this critique, and I'm quoting, Critical commentaries, especially around the turn of the century, made such an issue of the fact that Belshazzar was neither the son of Nebuchadnezzar nor the king of Babylon. This is still sometimes repeated as the charge against the historicity of Daniel and is resisted by conservative scholars. But it hasn't been clear since 1924 that although Nabonidus was the last king of the Neo-Babylonian dynasty, Belshazzar was effectively ruling Babylon. In this respect, then, Daniel is correct. The literal meaning of son should not be pressed, even if it might betray misunderstanding on the part of Daniel. A strong case against Daniel's historical reliability is not enhanced by the inclusion of weak arguments such as this. And with that, we end the quote of this author in this little book put out by the Journal for the Study of the Old Testament. That's interesting coming from someone who is still an advocate of the late-date view of Daniel. So he goes back more to this whole thing of the possibility of genuine revelation and prediction not being possible. And the historical setting has so much about Antiochus Epiphanes in the book of Daniel that you wonder how anyone could have written this unless he were living in the time of Antiochus Epiphanes, or unless you're willing to accept the possibility of divine revelation, which, of course, we do. There's a Babylonian text that makes it absolutely clear about Nabonidus and Belshazzar. There's a good article on that in the New ISBE Encyclopedia, that is the International Standard Biblical Encyclopedia, if you look up under Belshazzar. I think it's written by Edwin Yamauchi, who utilizes some of this Babylonian source material. The third thing that is alleged as historically inaccurate that I mentioned before is the question of this person called Darius the Mede. Critical scholars will say there never was such a person named Darius the Mede. This is a somewhat more difficult question because of lack of evidence. It's true that we have no reference to an individual by that name called Darius the Mede outside of Scripture. And it's also true that there is no interval between the Belshazzar-Nabonidus rule of Babylon and the fall of Babylon to Cyrus of Persia. Cyrus is the one historically who defeated Babylon during the time of Nabonidus and Belshazzar. So you see that the succession is Nabonidus and Belshazzar co-reigning, and then in 539 BC, Cyrus the Persian takes over. But I think, having said that, that does not necessarily mean that Daniel was in error here. There are several reasonable suggestions that have been made in attempting to identify this individual called Darius the Mede, who is mentioned there in Daniel chapter 5, verse 31, where it says, quote, Darius the Mede took the kingdom, end quote. It's possible that Darius the Mede is another name for Cyrus the Persian. It could perhaps be some sort of throne name or title. You remember with Tiglath-Pileser, the Babylonian, or rather the Assyrian king, he was known in Babylon as Pul. Tiglath-Pileser was an Assyrian king, as I mentioned. In 1 Chronicles chapter 5, verse 26, Tiglath-Pileser is called Pul. Notice the Babylonian name is used, even though he's Assyrian. Maybe this is a throne name of some sort, or a title for Cyrus, going back to the difference between Cyrus and Darius. Perhaps it's a title for Cyrus that otherwise has not been preserved. It's interesting, if you look at chapter 6, verse 28 of Daniel, you have the statements, quote, so this Daniel prospered in the reign of Darius and of the reign of Cyrus the Persian, end quote. These two phrases, reign of Darius and reign of Cyrus the Persian, are just connected by the simple Hebrew vav, and this could be translated even in the reign of Cyrus the Persian. You could have two individuals, or you could read this as follows. Daniel prospered in the reign of Darius, even in the reign of Cyrus the Persian, which would identify Cyrus and Darius as being the same person with two names. So that's one possibility. The other possibility has been suggested and worked out in some detail, and that is that Darius the Mede is another name for an individual called Gubaru, who was the governor that Cyrus appointed over the province of Babylon. In conquering Babylon, he made Gubaru the governor. And that individual, Gubaru, is mentioned in Babylonian text. So Darius could be another name for that individual. So I think the point is, as far as Darius the Mede is concerned, we don't have enough evidence to completely solve the identity of this individual. But that is no reason to conclude that this is a historical error or a blunder, and to conclude that the book of Daniel was written late. You know that principle of the fragmentary character of the archaeological evidence. So to allege that some uncorroborated statement is suspect if you don't have archaeological corroboration for it, that's a fallacious idea. Archaeological evidence is so minuscule when you think of all the possible things that could be corroborated that aren't. to draw the conclusion that because something isn't corroborated archaeologically, therefore its suspect is in some way methodologically simply not a good procedure. So I'd say at this point that there are at least two reasonable explanations as to how we are to understand this name, Darius the Mede. At present, we don't have further confirmation that would make one of these identifications certain. Maybe something else could come up that hasn't even been thought of, but I don't think that lack of corroboration is sufficient to warrant the radical conclusion that Daniel was written 400 years later and that this is a historical error. Now, for alleged late linguistic features, that's the third line of argument against the early date of Daniel. That argument centers on the use of several Greek loanwords that are found in Daniel. It's interesting that those loanwords are musical instruments, and they're found in chapter 3, verse 5, where you have, quote, "At the time you hear the sound of the horn, pipe, lyre, sackbut, and all kinds of music, fall down." And worship, that is, end quote. A number of those terms for musical instruments are Greek loanwords. In other words, they're just transliterated over from the Greek, but they're really Greek words. And of course, the conclusion is, by the critics, that if you have some Greek loanwords, then it must be in the Greek period that Daniel is written, or you wouldn't have the Greek words. The other line of argument on this linguistic basis is that there is Aramaic used of what is called a late type of Aramaic in the book of Daniel. You know there's a section in Daniel that is written in Aramaic instead of in Hebrew, and it's alleged that in that section the Aramaic is of a late type, more around what you would find around 165 BC rather than 400 years earlier. Now, I don't think, again, either of those arguments are convincing arguments. There's abundant evidence of contacts between the Greeks and the Near East long before the time of Alexander the Great, and particularly in the area of a name for a musical instrument. It's reasonable to expect in that case that something may have been imported into Babylon from the Greeks and the name came along with it. So it's not surprising because there's abundant evidence of those kinds of contacts between the East and the Greeks, not just musical instruments, but pottery as well. As far as the Aramaic question is concerned, you get into a really technical discussion here. I have a quotation here from Baldwin on that, page 35 of your citations. And there's also an article by K.A. Kitchen, or Kenneth Kitchen, called The Aramaic of Daniel. And he looks at A, the vocabulary, B, morphology and phonetics, and C, general considerations. It may be helpful to summarize the conclusion that Kitchen reaches as the result of his closely reasoned, well-documented work. And now I am quoting Kitchen. He says, "In the first place, the Aramaic of Daniel is shown to be imperial Aramaic, in itself practically undateable with any conviction within about 600 to 330 BC. It is, therefore, irrelevant to make distinctions between Eastern and Western Aramaic, which developed later. The only indication of the place of origin rises out of the word order, which betrays an Akkadian influence and proves that the Aramaic of Daniel belongs to the tradition of early imperial Aramaic, which dates to the 7th to 4th century BC as opposed to later Palestinian derivations of imperial Aramaic. Much has been made of the appearance of Greek words, and to the non-specialist, the Greek words might seem conclusive that they point to a period after Alexander the Great, until it is made clear that there are only three such words in Daniel and that they are all the names of musical instruments. Greek wares were being traded all over the ancient Near East from the 8th century onward. Greeks were apparently employed in Babylon during the time of Nebuchadnezzar, and there is nothing surprising about there being instruments of Greek origin bearing Greek names in Babylon of the 6th century BC. What is significant is that there are so few Greek loanwords in the Aramaic of Daniel." We continue with this quote. "According to M. Hengel," that is another commentator, From the time of Ptolemy, Jerusalem was a city in which Greek was spoken in increasing degree. It can be demonstrated from Zeno that the Greek language is known in aristocratic and military circles of Judaism in Palestine. It was already widespread at the accession of Antiochus IV in 175 BC and would hardly have been suppressed even by the victorious freedom fight of the Maccabees. From the 3rd century, we find almost exclusively Greek inscriptions in Palestine. And that is the end of the quote from Kitchen. By the way, Antiochus IV and Antiochus Epiphanes are the same person, mentioned by Kitchen. Well, the fact that no more than 3 Greek words appear in the Aramaic of Daniel, and those are technical terms, argue against the 2nd century date for the writing of the book. One would, on the Greek and Persian evidence, prefer to put the Aramaic of Daniel in the 6th to 4th century BC, not the 3rd or 2nd. The latter is not ruled out, but it is much less realistic and not too favored by the facts. In the continuing debate, the H.H. Rowley late date is contested by Kitchen's finding. H.H. Rowley was famous for promoting the late date of Daniel. All these arguments have been refuted by the leading Israeli scholar in a major survey of the state of research in early Aramaic, and it has been favored reasonably by other linguists. It is becoming an accepted fact that the date of Daniel cannot be decided on linguistic grounds, and that the increasing evidence does not favor the 2nd century position. So the whole linguistic question is a rather technical question, but there are competent people who have analyzed that in detail and have come up with well-argued conclusions that do not support the late date for the book, in spite of many allegations to the contrary by the critics. In your bibliography, I've listed a number of articles on this issue. Notice on page 6, the 3rd entry in this article is the one by Kitchen, The Aramaic of Daniel, and this is in the Book of Daniel, a book edited by D.J. Weissman. Then we have Weissman's article that shows some historical problems in the Book of Daniel, and then 3 articles by Yamauchi, all of which are useful. And these articles are The Archaeological Background of Daniel, Daniel in Context Between the Aegean and the Near East Before Alexander, and then the 3rd article, The Greek Words in Daniel. Now, particularly here, Kitchen, Weissman, and Yamauchi's articles are helpful if you're interested in this whole question of the date of Daniel, and they give solid responses to the critical arguments. So, by way of conclusion, it seems to me that there are no compelling reasons for dating Daniel late. There are adequate answers for each of the historical and linguistic arguments for late dating the book. I think the underlying question is whether or not one is willing to accept the possibility of genuine predictive prophecy. And if you are convinced that Daniel could not have spoken so clearly about the future, or especially about the time of Antiochus Epiphanes in detail, then you must seek a date subsequent to that time or in that time. For those who accept the possibility of genuine prediction, this material then is viewed, as many other sections of Scripture, as evidence that there is a God who does speak, and a God who is sovereign over history and controls history and can tell in advance what is going to come to pass. So now let's go to number 2 in the outline under introductory remarks, and that is some general remarks on the content of the book in relation to its purpose. The book of Daniel is generally divided into 2 main sections, chapters 1 to 6, a historical section, and then chapters 7 to 12, a prophetic section. Prophetical there in the sense of predictive. In chapters 1 to 6, you have narrative, and in chapters 1 to 6, the material is divided quite well. There are 6 separate narratives and 6 stories about various individuals. That includes Daniel, his friends, and various kings. In the prophetic sections, instead of narratives, there are visions, and you really have 4 visions. There's a vision in chapter 7, a vision in chapter 8, one in chapter 9, and then Chapters 10, 11, and 12 are the fourth vision, these chapters taken together. Those chapters really can be grouped together, that is 10, 11, and 12. So you have four visions in chapters 7 through 12. That second section, chapters 7 through 12, is almost exclusively predictive. History there is pretty much incidental. The material is predictive discourse, and it's predictive material. In the first section, five out of the six chapters are narrative material. But one chapter in the first section, while being in a narrative context, is largely predictive, and that's chapter 2. Chapter 2 is a vision of that image given to Nebuchadnezzar and Daniel's interpretation of that vision. So chapter 2 in that first section, section 1 to 6, bears some similarity to the material in chapters 7 to 12, although it's put in the narrative context. So that means there are really seven chapters in the book that are largely predictive and five that are narrative out of the total 12 chapters. Now, when you look at that first section, the historical section, I think when you read through those chapters and reflect on them a bit, it's not historical narrative in the normal sense of historical narrative, such as you have in the Book of Kings, for example, where you have a connected presentation of history. What I mean by that is you don't have a history of Babylon. You don't have a history of Persia. You learn something about Babylon, and you learn something about Nebuchadnezzar. You learn something about the Persian period, but you don't have any connected presentation of these nations. Neither is it biographical in the sense of giving a life of Daniel. There's no connected presentation of the life of Daniel, so it's not a history of his life. You learn something about certain incidents in his life, but no connected presentation about his life or activity. So the first six chapters are not historical narrative in the sense of giving a connected discourse on some period of history connected with Babylon or Persia or Daniel, nor is there any unifying principle in connecting all these three. Again, we are talking about incidences. So you might ask, what is the organizational principle of the book? Why is this material placed in the first part of the book in the way in which we find it? I'd like to run through it quickly with you. It's not a history of Babylon or of Israel or of Daniel, as I mentioned. But when you look at the chapters one by one, you notice in chapter 1 you have that story of Daniel and his friends refusing to meet the king's demands, and then God blesses them for their faithfulness. I think what you find in chapter 1 is God blesses Daniel and his friends for faithfulness. They're put in a situation where it would be very difficult to be faithful to the Lord. But they are faithful to the Lord, and he blesses them for it. In chapter 2, Daniel interprets the king's vision. But when you read the entire chapter, you find that the great idea in the chapter is that even though Nebuchadnezzar may be a powerful king, God is more powerful. God is supreme over Nebuchadnezzar and over all such rulers. Look at verse 47 of chapter 2. This is towards the end of the chapter. We read, "The king answered unto Daniel and said, Of a truth it is that your God is the God of gods, the Lord of kings, and a revealer of secrets, seeing you could reveal the secret." End quote. That's out of the mouth of Nebuchadnezzar himself. He says, "Your God is the God of gods, the Lord of kings." So you have the confession of this sovereign of the God of Israel, the God of Daniel. God is supreme over Nebuchadnezzar and over all such rulers. Chapter 3 is the chapter where Nebuchadnezzar gives a command that requires idolatry. "Bow down to this image," he says, and the three men, friends of Daniel, refuse to obey him. Because they refuse, they're put in that burning, fiery furnace, but God delivers those friends. Again, you find a demonstration of the power and the sovereignty of God, which Nebuchadnezzar himself admits. Notice verses 17 and 18. This is the response of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego to Nebuchadnezzar. And they say, we quote, "We are not careful to answer thee in this manner." By the expression, "we are not careful to answer thee," it means that we have no need to answer you. That's the end of verse 16. But then they go on. If it be so, our God, whom we serve, is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace, and he will deliver us out of your hand, O king. But if not, be it known unto thee, O king, we will not serve thy gods, nor worship the golden image which thou hast set up. End quote. Notice the idea here. The idea is not that God will protect you no matter what difficult situation you are in. That's not the point. The idea is, regardless of the result, we should follow the Lord because he is greater than Nebuchadnezzar and more powerful than any other force in all the earth. If he desires, he's able to deliver, and God is able to do that. So we should follow the Lord and his will because he is greater than Nebuchadnezzar and more powerful than all the forces of the earth. Notice at the end of the chapter, after they were preserved alive and delivered, in verse 28, Nebuchadnezzar speaks and says, "Blessed be the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who has sent his angel and delivered his servants who trusted in him, and have changed the king's word, and have yielded their bodies, that they might not serve nor worship any god except their own God." End quote. Now, chapter 4, I want just quickly to run through these chapters before we look at some of them in more detail. In chapter 4, Nebuchadnezzar declares his greatness, and then God strikes him with madness and tells him he will live among the animals of the field. And that happens. Then, when Nebuchadnezzar confesses the greatness of God, he is restored to normal. Notice verse 25 in chapter 4, quote, "They shall drive thee from men, thy dwelling shall be with the beasts of the field. They shall make thee eat grass like oxen. They shall wet thee, and the dew of heaven will be upon you. Seven times shall pass over thee, till thou know that the Most High ruleth in the kingdom of men, and giveth it to whomever he will." End quote. As you can tell, I was reading from the King James. And then you read in verse 28, "All this came upon King Nebuchadnezzar. At the end of 12 months he walked the halls in the palace of the kingdom of Babylon. The king spoke and said, Is this not great Babylon that I have built for the house of the kingdom by the might of my power and the honor of my majesty?" Notice he's exalting himself. And then we read, "While the word was yet in the king's mouth, there fell a voice from heaven saying, O King Nebuchadnezzar, to thee it is spoken, the kingdom is departed from thee, and they shall drive thee from men, and thy dwelling shall be with the beasts of the field. They shall make thee eat grass like oxen. Seven times shall pass over thee, till thou know that the God Most High ruleth in the kingdom of men, and gives it to whomever he wills." That same hour was the thing fulfilled upon Nebuchadnezzar, and he did eat grass like oxen. End quote. And then in verse 34 we read, "At the end of the days I, Nebuchadnezzar, lifted mine eyes unto heaven. Mine understanding returned unto me. I blessed the Most High, and I praised and honored him who liveth forever. His dominion is an everlasting dominion, and his kingdom is from generation to generation. And all the inhabitants of the earth are reputed as nothing, and he doeth according to his will in the army of heaven." End quote. And so forth. And then in verse 37, we finally have, "Now I, Nebuchadnezzar, praise and extol and honor the King of heaven." So, God's supremacy over earthly rulers. That's chapter 4, and this is shown as an example, specifically over the actions of Nebuchadnezzar. Now, whether it's 7 years or not that Nebuchadnezzar was crawling around like an ox, we don't know, but you do have that phrase seven times. It is undefined. It may be seven smaller periods of time than 7 years. It could possibly be 7 weeks, or it could have been 7 days. It's hard to say. I wouldn't assume that it's 7 years, but apparently, however long the period was, Nebuchadnezzar was able to come back into power. So that would make it very unlikely that it's 7 years. See verse 34, it says, "At the end of days, I, Nebuchadnezzar, lifted up mine eyes." Now, there's apparently an illness that has been documented that is similar to what Nebuchadnezzar experienced. There's a term for it. It's called lycanthropy. A similar thing affected King George III of England as well as Otto of Bavaria in modern times. So it seems like a strange condition that someone would exhibit that kind of a form of mental illness, but apparently it's something that's not unique. It's something that's known from other examples of a similar thing happening. It does say there that till Nebuchadnezzar's hairs were grown like eagle's feathers and his nails like bird claws, that he would be out on the ground. It does sound longer than 7 days or 7 weeks, but I think it's hard to know that what the seven times mean exactly. Chapter 6 is God's supremacy over earthly rulers and nature. Chapter 6 is the chapter where Darius the Mede is now the ruler. He made, at the persuasion of some of his officials, the law that nobody would worship anybody but him personally. And Daniel, of course, refused to do that. He continued to worship the Lord and to pray towards Jerusalem 3 times each day. And because of that, he's put in the lion's den. But God protected and rescued him. At the end of that chapter, chapter 6, notice that King Darius says, in verse 25, quote, King Darius wrote unto the people, all people, nations, languages that dwell in all the earth, peace be multiplied unto you. I make a decree that in every dominion of my kingdom men tremble in fear before the God of Daniel, for he is the living God and steadfast forever in his kingdom, that which shall not be destroyed. And his dominion shall be even unto the end. He delivers and rescues and works signs and wonders in heaven and earth, who has delivered Daniel from the power of the lions. So this Daniel prospered in the reign of Darius and, or even too, the reign of Cyrus the Persian. End quote. So it's the same theme, you see. It's God's supremacy over earthly rulers and nature and over Darius and the lions. So when you look through it quickly, through the first 6 chapters, the thing that's central to all those chapters is that God is supreme over nature, over history, and over human rulers. So it's not really so much a history in the technical sense of some sort of connected discourse about some particular kingdom or king or individual. Rather, there's a theme that runs through these narratives. God is supreme. Jerusalem might be destroyed, the temple may perish. It may seem that wicked rulers are in control, but in spite of all that, it is God who is supreme. God's people may be faced with terrible difficulties and persecutions, but God is able, if he chooses, and that if he chooses is important, he's able to make things turn out the way he wishes. It's made explicit there in the case of the fiery furnace. God is able, if he chooses, to deliver the 3 friends of Daniel out of the difficulties, no matter how great they might be, and in this case, he chose to do so. So I think Daniel chapters 1 to 6 is almost what you might call a sermon that presents the theme of God's sovereignty with a series of illustrations from the life of Daniel and the lives of his friends, and some from the lives of these kings with whom they came in contact. So it's not Daniel that's the primary subject. It's not Nebuchadnezzar or Cyrus, but God is the focus of Daniel. And the point is to show that he's supreme over the nations of the earth, and that because of that, one should be true to God in whatever situation one finds himself or herself, because one can know that God indeed is sovereign. Now, that truth is certainly an important truth for all of us, but I think a truth of particular importance for God's people at particular times in their history. That idea is particularly needed for people who undergo persecution for loyalty to God. Awareness and confidence in God's sovereignty is instrumental in getting through the periods. That's the specific purpose behind these 6 chapters. Remember the context. The people are in Babylon. From what we know of the time, Israel was in captivity in Babylon. There wasn't any great amount of persecution, but there was some. It seems that it was more sporadic than systematic. We have several incidences of persecution here, but there doesn't seem to be any widespread persecution during the Babylonian exile. You move to the Persian period, and it seems to be very similar. There is no systematic persecution there either. You remember the story of Esther, and there was an attempt there to wipe out the Jewish people, but that didn't succeed either, and that seems to be more isolated than something that's characteristic of the Persian period. The Persian period was destroyed by Alexander the Great, and then after his death, which happened rather quickly, Palestine came under the rule of the Ptolemies. Ptolemy was a general of Alexander who seized the section of Alexander's kingdom in the Egyptian area, and he controlled Palestine as well for about 100 years. And then there wasn't great persecution under the Ptolemaic rule of Palestine either. But war developed between the Ptolemies down there in Egypt and the Seleucids in the area of Damascus and Syria for control of Palestine. They struggled back and forth. Eventually, the Seleucids were able to take control of Palestine. And again, there wasn't a great deal of difficulty as far as general persecution went in the early part of the Seleucid rule, until this fellow named Antiochus Epiphanes, or Antiochus IV, who was dated 175 to 164 BC, came to power. He decided to put an end to Jewish religion. He wanted to integrate the Jews into Hellenistic culture. He was a promoter of Hellenistic culture. He wanted them, that is the Jews, to participate in naked exercises, to eat pork, to do other things contrary to the law of Moses. Now some of the Jews followed him, but many of them resisted. The books of 1 and 2 Maccabees give accounts of the persecution that arose under Antiochus Epiphanes on all those who wouldn't obey his commands. So, through all subsequent Jewish history, Antiochus Epiphanes is looked upon as the great persecutor of the Jewish people and a terrible enemy of the Jews. 1 Maccabees tells how a group of Jewish people rose up. Mattathias, who was a priest, and his five sons, John, Simon, Judas, Eleazar, and Jonathan, resisted Antiochus. They waged a guerrilla war against this terrible persecutor. And by 164 BC, worship was restored in the temple after it had been desecrated by Antiochus. Now, that's just a long, brief sketch of history with respect to this matter of persecution. It seems logical, I think, in light of that history and in light of the content of the book of Daniel, to conclude that one of the reasons for the writing of the book is to prepare the Jews for the time of Antiochus Epiphanes and to give them encouragement during this period of persecution and difficulty that was to come. In fact, what you find is one of the greatest persecutions in the whole history of God's people occurred under this very same Antiochus Epiphanes. That period is the first great period of persecution after the writing of the book. In other words, it doesn't seem like there was systematic persecution under the Babylonians, the Persians, the Greeks, until the time of Antiochus Epiphanes. So it seems that that's one of the primary purposes for the writing of the book of Daniel. I repeat, to prepare the people when Antiochus comes, to show them what was going to happen and to be able to resist. This ends lecture number
21
by Robert Benoit on the Major Prophets. This is the first lecture on the book of Daniel.